From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Did you have an abnormally dry growing season this year, one where it felt like you just couldn't keep up with the watering maybe? Well, today's guest, naturalist and artist Julie Zicafus, and I both did in our otherwise different garden locations, places that usually have plenty of rain. And besides prompting frustration and some plant failures, the dry times also had us making observations about the impact of drought on various forms of wildlife. More in a moment from two longtime gardeners recalling their driest year ever, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Julie Zicafus lives and gardens in the Appalachian foothills of southeast Ohio. You probably know her from one of the books she's written and illustrated, like my favorite of all, Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. And besides being an author and artist, Julie's a wildlife rehabilitator and a keen gardener, too. I'm glad to welcome her back to the show today to commiserate about a season that really threw us both and what we learned from it and its impact on gardeners, plants, birds, and other wildlife. Hi, Julie. How are you?
Hey, Margaret. It is so nice not to feel alone in our drought despair.
Yeah. Well, we got to catching up on the phone the other day, and you know, the topic quickly shifted to drought. And before we go there, I just wanted to say that because I think of you as bird lady, you know, two Saturdays ago, I think it was finally cold enough here in the Hudson Valley of New York to put out my bird feeders because of bears. I can't do so otherwise. And, you know, feeder season always makes me think of you. And do you want to guess, like clockwork, who showed up first? What species showed up first within about 15 minutes?
It's not a Wilson's warbler.
No, I get chickadees are the ones who always find the feeders first here. You know, the black-capped chickadees. It's hilarious. They're like the little messengers, you know, that tell everybody then.
Yeah.
It's so cute.
That role is taken by tufted titmice here. They are our policemen. They don't miss a thing. They do not miss a thing. And I love them dearly.
Yes, well, and the toughies, as I like to think of them, the toughies came in within about 2 minutes, and within 24 hours, there were like 15 species feeding, you know? So it's like, if you build it, they will come, huh?
Exactly. And it also speaks to the fact that birds are forever watching each other and taking each other's leads. And when I was doing a lot of rehab, when I'd have a very frightened, wild, individual come in, I would cage it right next to some long-term clients who were, you know, had permanent injuries and things like that. And that bird would settle down right away.
Take the signals from the old timers, huh?
If this orchard oriole and this house finch are eating out of their cups, why, I'm going to eat out of a cup too, you know?
So interesting.
It was magic. Yeah. There's a lot to be said for having role models in bird world.
Yeah. So everybody followed the chickadees here to the sustenance. And on the other end of things, if you're lacking in some form of sustenance, like, well, most of the country, frankly, was this last year and is, there's a lot of drought in a lot of places or abnormally dry conditions. But I'm kind of a newcomer. And I think you and I both were saying that the other day on the phone, that we feel like we're a little bit of newcomers to drought. Usually, is your soil kind of moist enough to sort of get along and garden?
Oh, yeah. We have a pretty deep loam here, sandy loam. And really the last like five summers have been wet enough that I haven't had to pull out the hose much. Not at all summer before this last one. And I don't take it for granted. You know, when you don't have to water, it's like magic. It's like gardening ought to be, right?
Right.
Yeah. And then last summer was just the heartbreaker. I'm still heartbroken from it.
Yeah. I think both of our areas, like I said, you're in Southeast Ohio and I'm in sort of the Hudson Valley of New York. And I think both of us are, quote, normal rainfall is in the 40 something inches, you know, 42, 43, 44 inches a year, something like that. And you know, we were down, I think in this area, we were down 6 or 8 inches below normal at one point. And yeah, the last few weeks we've started to have some precipitation, but it's going to take a lot of time to get back. And the soil was unfamiliar. I mean, the texture of the soil and the way the soil just was like, it was like concrete in some places, like cracking open.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I had wide cracks open in my yard. And I think the most shocking thing for me was seeing the streams run dry.
Yes.
And just, you know, going down in the woods and saying, my God, there's nothing here for anything to drink.
Yes.
And that was that, that just frightened me. And all, you know, what little pools remained in the larger streams would be full of minnows just darting frantically. And you know that, you know, predators were cleaning those up. So it was very, very hard. And, you know, being an amphibian fan, just to watch everything just dry up and with no hope was very difficult.
Yeah. When I look at the U.S. drought monitor map, and it's definitely improved the last month, because, as I said, in some areas like mine, we've started to have some rain. But I think it was maybe 48 of the 50 states. I mean, I think it was only Alaska and maybe like Kentucky or something that weren't color coded as having some degree of abnormal dryness or drought. Do you know what I mean? It was like almost everywhere.
Yes, I was absolutely, you know, riveted by drought.gov.
Yes.
Which is, I would go like every couple of days and say, yep, extreme. Oh, moving on toward exceptional. Great. Wonderful. You know, my area was right on the edge of a dark maroon blob that included Charleston, West Virginia.
Right.
And that was the exceptional drought. We may be there now. I don't know. I haven't had the heart to look since it got cold, since I'm kidding myself that it's now not in a drought, but it still is.
Yeah. Farmer friends and neighbors, I mean, we're both in rural areas and there's a lot of farmers where I am. And, you know, they had crop losses in some cases or definitely underperformance in a lot of their crops. And I mean, I have to acknowledge, I pulled out my vegetable starts. When I saw the stream nearby go dry, the brook down the road go dry or almost dry, I just thought to myself, I'm on a well. I have a, you know, a private well because we don't have public water. And I just thought to myself, you know what, Margaret, you're not going to run your well dry. You're not going to use water for things other than the most essential. I'm not going to indulge myself in annuals and vegetables and so forth. I can buy those for my farmer neighbors. You know what I mean? I just had to prioritize triage, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yes. Having lived with a shallow well in Connecticut, I know very well that math. I am stupid. I have town water. And I'm also really stubborn, and like giving up my sugar snap peas was not something I was ready to do. So I watered all summer long.
Yeah. And I have to say that you say sugar snap peas and the peas and also green beans were the two things I really missed the most, because there's nothing like just pulling those right off the vine and eating them barely before you even turn around and walk a foot. You know what I mean? It's just,
exactly.
They're just so fabulous.
Cooking in the garden. Yep.
Yeah. So animals. So we can talk a little bit more about kind of strategies for next time around and so forth later. But animal wise, you said, you know, you're an amphibian lover, as am I. I'm a frog nut, and especially, and lots of salamanders around here and so forth. And I have in-ground, you know, I have a couple of in-ground decent-sized pools that I made years ago that I keep, you know, water available year-round to everybody. Mm-hmm. But you had, I remember, I think it was on Instagram or on your blog, I can't remember, maybe both.
Both.
Some of the sort of ruts in the road, almost, like they ended up having, I think, tadpoles in them. Is that right? Am I making that up?
I had three species, mountain chorus frog, which is a regional specialty, Cope's gray tree frog, and American toad. No, I don't think I actually wound up succeeding with American toad, but those two species were in there in great numbers. And like a moron, I committed to keeping the water in the puddles. And I had no idea, of course, that it would be, an historic drought. So,
Right.
yeah. So in June, when it stopped raining at the end of May, and in June I started hauling water with 5 gallon jugs, using my tractor with a little trailer behind it, my lawn tractor. I started hauling water, and by the end of August, I was putting 40 gallons in every other day.
Oh my.
Oh my God, you have no idea what that does to your back.
Yeah,
So
well, I mean, I'm
lifting,
just visualizing. Yeah, no.
lifting those things. I got smart. I worked smarter. I filled them with the hose while they were in the trailer, so I wouldn't be lifting a
Right,
loaded.
one less lift. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And then I could tip them from the trailer into the puddle, but it was still awful. And I just wouldn't give up because I'd had such poor success trying to raise them in containers. Well, by the end of
Right.
August, I said, this is stupid. This is ridiculous. So I made some palatial containers for them with live plants and silt on the bottom, and brought them up to the house and started, trying to rear them. And they did a lot better, but what hit me was that it had been 11 weeks and these things had not metamorphosed,
Right.
which is abnormal. So I knew that they were not getting some stimulus from the environment to tell them it's safe to go.
Right.
Obviously,
It's safe to
it's
what do you
safe
call it,
to leave the
resorb or
home.
absorb that tail and get
Exactly.
legs and stuff like that. Yeah.
Exactly. So they weren't, whether it's, raindrops sluicing into the puddle, whether it's something in the temperature, I don't know what it is, but they weren't getting that signal. So I said to myself, I could be doing this into the winter. I have no idea. So I threw up the white flag and I took them to a beaver pond nearby. And I just said, you guys are on your own. I can't do this anymore. And I was just out there and I looked at that puddle, which has formed since we got 0.7 inches of rain last night. And I'm going to fill it in because otherwise
Right.
my stupid heart will make me do that again.
Because in a dry, abnormally dry situation, an animal like a female amphibian is going to look for any amount of water to put to lay her eggs in. And right, I mean, isn't this what? Yeah, so you're going to end up with a repeat of the situation.
Yes, yes. And it'll
Yeah.
be mine to worry about. She's danced back off into the forest and gone into estivation, and I'm raising her babies,
Right, right, right,
It's
right,
not right.
right,
So,
right.
and
What's
the
wrong
other
with
thing,
this picture?
right. What's wrong with this picture is I'm an idiot. The other thing that happened was the deer keyed into that puddle, and they were the ones who drank it dry in 2 days.
Oh,
They
so
were
it became a watering hole. Oh,
exactly. It
okay.
was the only watering hole on my ridge. So
Okay.
they knew we're taking 40 gallons every 2 days. And what I wound up doing was putting out great big tubs of water in my yard for the deer.
Right.
Because it hit me that they were either going to have to leave the area or they were going to die. And I didn't want that to happen. So now I have deer who come still every day and every night to these tubs that I'm keeping out for them. And now I'm going to put heaters in the tubs because there's still no water out there for them.
And we should say, explain to people, you live on a preserve, kind of. I mean, it's
Yeah, it's a
a
private sanctuary.
sanctuary, a private sanctuary. Yeah. So
Yeah,
it's not
acreage.
a a conventional yard where, oh my goodness, to have deer would mean no garden at all. Or it's a very different type of environment. And so deer are part of the ecosystem and so forth. So it's not you're not completely
It's
nutty.
not. Yeah, this is. Yeah. Well, I'm a nut, and the deer are beginning. The ones that have gotten very tame since the drought have begun. They ate my asparagus. Who knew they would
Well,
need
they do
asparagus?
habituate to if we give them an inch, they take a mile. They certainly
That's
do
right.
habituate.
That's exactly right. So I'm kind of watching it. Right now it's just these three, the mother and her two fawns, and she had brought her fawns last year. So, I get attached. I like them. I dig these animals and I don't want them to suffer. I don't want any animal to suffer, so I do offer them water. Yeah.
Did you also see, I think with your bluebirds, you also saw some impact. I mean, obviously there was impact of the drought on everybody, every living creature, plant or animal. But what about with the bluebirds? Because I mean, you've written books about bluebirds. Bluebirds have been almost like a signature of your work for a long time. And
yes.
Yeah. So
Absolutely.
What about that?
Yeah. Well, this was crazy. I went into this expecting it to be an awful year for bluebirds because, you know, by my magic logic, there would, if there was no rain, there were no bugs. But
right, no insects for them to feed, to eat, the parent to eat or to feed to the babies, yeah?
Right, right. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking this is going to be a crash. And what happened was they had a banner year.
Oh.
And I have been dissecting the data and looking at it. And here's what's crazy. Out of 28 clutches of eggs laid in my boxes, 10 of them were 5-egg clutches, which is a much higher proportion of 5-egg clutches than I usually get. I usually get 4-egg clutches here. So first off, they were laying more eggs, but then they raised more babies successfully.
Huh.
And so I had 106 bluebirds hatch in 15 boxes in 2024. And I tried to get around and sex the babies, you know, determine the sex by the color of their plumage. But I was traveling a bit, so I didn't get to them all. But of the 74 nestlings that I was here to sex in 2024, I got 51 females to 23 males.
Oh, girls rule, huh?
Yeah, girls ruled. So females comprised 69% of all the nestlings I was able to sex. Yeah. So I've got to think, since the sex ratio is usually nearly even in my birds, that the drought had something to do with it. It was the only obvious anomaly, you know.
Huh.
So yeah, it was hot this summer, but ambient temperature hasn't been shown to determine the sex of any bird embryo, except those of the Australian mallee fowl, which lays its eggs in rotting compost. So,
and you don't have in Ohio, that bird.
Yeah. I haven't seen a mallee fowl lately. Uh-huh. So here's this crazy thing. There's this sex allocation theory that was developed by Trivers and Willard in 1973. It's often presented to explain extreme sex ratio deviations. And by this theory, a female of whatever organism is going to, if she is in poor condition, she will benefit from producing more female offspring.
Oh.
And that's because female offspring, even low quality female offspring, are much more likely to be successful in obtaining mates than would low quality males.
Oh.
So producing females would represent a bigger fitness gain to the mother.
Huh.
So we don't know by what mechanism sex in bird eggs is determined. And it doesn't really jibe with my findings because a female bluebird in poor condition is not going to lay 5 eggs.
Right, right. So maybe more females, but not more eggs. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe more females, but not more eggs.
So right.
When I think about this. And then what I've kind of settled on is almost all of my bluebird boxes are on the edge of hay fields.
Mm-hmm.
And when the hay is cut and the grass is short, they can see crickets and grasshoppers and spiders, and they can rattle. As soon as the hay gets high and thick, they stop nesting in those boxes because they no longer have foraging habitat.
Hmm.
Then when the hay is cut again, they can forage there. Now this year, the hay was so poor and thin that they could see the crickets and grasshoppers even when the hay was high. So they continue nesting in those hay fields, whereas they normally would have to stop.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All that's right. So that was the other variable. That was the other difference. I see.
Right. Right. So no rain meant thin hay meant bluebirds were like, hey, the grass is long, but I can still see the ground, you know?
Right. Right. And I could find my prey. Right.
That's right.
And feed my babies and myself.
That's right. So I had triple brooding, whereas normally they would get one or maybe two broods in, they'd be done.
Right.
So I had triple brooding, larger clutches, more eggs, and weirdly, way more females than males.
And I guess, I mean, for me, this story is, and obviously you're a complete bird nerd and lots of people listening aren't, but this is the thing about, you know, and as I have been saying recently, since I read a book called Slow Birding by Joan Strossman a couple of years ago, is that in the phrase bird watching, we need to emphasize the watching, right? Mm. The watching, because what you're doing is really observing. It's not, you're just not naming, oh, it's this species, it's that species, check, check, check. You're really watching. You really know these birds, and you're doing your homework.
Yeah. You're living with them, and you're moving through their reproductive biology with them.
Right.
Their phenology, the onset, the end. You know, you're there for everything when you run bluebird boxes. You know what's going on, and that's what's so valuable about that is that you get an intimate look at their daily life that you could not get any other way.
Right. So I want to make sure we have time to talk about, you know, sort of double back from our animal neighbors and companions to, you know, kind of as gardeners, what this was like. And as a sort of a transition, I guess I think it's key for everyone to have water available 365 days a year. Like you were just saying, you're going to keep your buckets or cattle tanks or whatever they are for the deer, you're going to keep them defrosted, so to speak, de-iced. I think that's a really important point for every gardener to have access to water for all the creatures of the garden. But as far as like plants, and I said I pulled out my vegetables and so forth, are you doing anything, going to do anything differently after running around like a maniac, watering like crazy this last year? Was there any resolve or whatever? I'm really thinking, frankly, I'd really like to have a few things, like we talked about the peas and so forth, and I'd really like to have some salad greens and some herbs. I'm thinking of putting some manageable sized containers near the house where I can manage it. Do you know? Mm-hmm.
I think that's brilliant. You know, if the drought forces us all to live like we just have an apartment balcony to garden, you know, then that's what might need to happen. Being as I've mentioned, kind of slow, I'm actually going to redo my raised bed, my big raised garden bed this winter, and raise the sides, make the soil deeper, and just mulch like crazy, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to deal with weeds. I have quit using straw mulch because all it is seeds.
Yeah.
Just a nightmare in the spring, you know. Last year, I used huge sheets of cardboard and newspaper. Mm-hmm. And I covered every surface that didn't have a plant in it. I literally cut a hole for the plant, you know, and I would water directly into those holes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I saved a lot of water that way, just by heavy, heavy, heavy mulching. And I intend to do that again next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely, I mean, I see pictures, you know, online and whatever. I see pictures of almost like big window boxes on legs, like, you know, footed. You know what I mean? The containers that are like on a stand, like a... it's like a bookshelf, but it's instead of a shelf on top, it's a box.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of thinking, okay, you know, certain things, that's all the space. I mean, I'm talking about a good size, not 2 feet, but you know, a bigger, longer one. I mean, that's manageable. And if it's deep, as you're pointing out, you're going to even deepen your in-ground beds. If it's deep so that it has enough insulation and can hold enough moisture. Yeah. I think that sort of is appealing to me at the moment.
I think it's brilliant. And, you know, I've never grown lettuce in anything but containers because it's
right.
Water requirements are simply too high. If I can keep it moist by growing it on my front porch and watering it with wastewater from the faucet, it's going to do great, you know, and with the added bonus that if I elevate it, the rabbits can't get it.
Right. And you just said wastewater from the faucet. So like when you first turn on the water, say you're going to wash your dishes or something, there's a lot of lost water waiting for the hot to come on, right? Oh, are you saving that?
I have a 2.5 gallon watering can by every single faucet in the house. And I always run the startup water into the can, and you would not believe it gives me enough water to water my greenhouse and then some.
Oh.
And so I actually do not run water to water my greenhouse. I just use startup water. Yeah.
Huh. So you have a can near each, that's a great idea, near each sink. Yeah.
Yeah. It drove my late husband nuts. He was forever running into the cans, tripping over them, cursing, kicking them. And I step around them. I know they're there.
Right. Right. I tend to have like I'll fill something, whatever vessel is nearest to the sink when I'm like when I first turn on the dishes, then I'll go water a house plant right then, you know, with it, like the tea kettle or the, you know, that's what I tend to do.
Sure. Sometimes a spaghetti pot, whatever's there, you know.
So in the last couple of minutes, I just wanted to say the other thing that we have in common besides trying to figure our way through facing potential dry seasons that may be to come. We're both on a tirade against woody invasives, yes. We're both. Is that your other big sort of priority at the moment? Because that's been mine.
I make these giant eagle nests of invasive carcasses all around my place, and that's actually my I call it cross training. I do it all winter long. I go out with my electric chainsaw and cut autumn olive, Japanese honeysuckle, Amur honeysuckle, privet, multiflora rose, and I'm actually winning, Margaret. I'm winning, and it is unbelievable to see dogwoods that you've peeled off multiflora rose and Japanese honeysuckle, and they have these huge, deep scars in their trunks, and they bloom and they say, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's so wonderful.
So you're rescuing the native woody plants by taking away all these invaders,
Right, right, right.
Well, I'm always glad to talk to you and bird lady. Because I think if you and I was thinking I maybe let's do a giveaway of Saving Jemima because I love that book. So I think with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com, I'm going to give away a copy of Saving Jemima because I think that'll be fun. But thank you and again thanks especially for your reminder with your anecdote about the bluebirds and their reproduction this year, the differences to really watch, you know, that we can look more closely because I think that's what it's all about really.
Yes, that and preparing to be surprised, because just keeping your mind completely open and say, wait, why did we have a banner year? You know, what was going on here? Yeah, preparing to be surprised, I think, is great.
Well, I hope I'll talk to you soon again, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram is at awaytogarden. And happy gardening and watching wildlife meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.